Welcome back to Questioning Medicine 2015, and we are back at it again. As promised, a three-part series here on kind of destroying the speculum. We've been thinking, what's some good music we could have to lead in to this segment? Joe, you got any ideas?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I had a great mentor in medical school, that Dr. Harris, a rheumatologist, that used to lead in with a little bit of rock trivia, Andrew, and I've got a little bit for you. Let's see if you can get this. It might be a little bit old for you, but what 1980s number one hit on the Billboard charts was banned in multiple states for being inappropriate?
1980s.
Yeah, you might
song hit the charts. I was born in the 80s. Hit the charts, banned in multiple states. Give me a second to think about this one. Welcome back to Question Medicine. This is Andrew Bill, and I am down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida.
This is Joe Weatherly, and we are just getting ready to get physical about the physical exam.
Yes, we are. So once again, this is part two of a three-part series. Part one was a rebroadcast of You Do Not Need a Speculum Any Longer, BV, Chlamydia, Gonorrhea, Screening for Ovarian Cancer. Smart EM has already done an excellent dive on using the speculum and threatened abortions. They don't talk necessarily about the speculum in general, but just threatened abortions, and I think you should go there to listen to that one. So now we have really only one other time I can think where you would just routinely grab for that speculum, and that is to screen for cervical cancer. And that is what we're going to be talking about over the course of these next two episodes.
Yeah, that's important. I mean, I don't know how else, Andrew, how in the world could you possibly imagine screening for cervical cancer without a speculum?
It's
got to be good.
This is going to be good. So that is where we were planning this podcast months ago, and then somebody else was thinking along the same lines as we are, and so I'm just going to jump out with that, and that is the Society of Gynecologic Oncology and the American Society of Colposcopy and Cervical Pathology. In January of this year, they came out guidelines that says HPV testing is good enough. Only HPV testing. And this is an excellent document if you haven't read it. Very well-written, evidence-based piece of literature. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to be talking a little bit about just, once again, some more of the evidence. I think the one thing that this podcast needs to address and has to convince you by the time it's done is that HPV is good enough when we're looking for cancer.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, most of the time. I mean, that's one of the interesting things we found is that so much literature is out there on HPV co-testing. We have so many great trials trying to bring when we went from cytology alone to cytology with high-risk HPV testing, now we're really sure high-risk HPV testing is good anytime there's abnormal cytology. And I think it's just a natural evolution to go with what's working the best, what's finding the most cancer. Some of the literature isn't clear about exactly how much of the cervical cancers we're going to catch if we stick with HPV. But again, this is kind of the newest, best available evidence, and before we go too far, just to say, you know, you should always take a good history. If your patient's mom died of cervical cancer, both of her sisters have cervical cancer, her neighbors all have cervical cancer, even the men, probably do a little bit more aggressive testing. But we're talking about primary screening, low-risk population that hasn't had any abnormals previously. Or maybe all the abnormals previously were from cytology and they came back to be normal a short time later.
Exactly. Or even if they had abnormals just on the high-risk HPV and then it regressed and went to just no more HPV, they fall back into the low-risk screening population. And as I said, these guidelines are excellent, and we'll get into them for just a little bit here. One of the things I love is that it comes right out almost at the very beginning and says, we had to make several assumptions writing these guidelines, and one of them was no screening test is perfect. No screening test is going to catch every cancer we have, and we know that. And to see a screening guidelines or guidance, as it's called, it's not guidelines, guidance, so just give you guidance in your practice. It's not gold, it's just a document. But to see something come out and say, we're not perfect, and we know that there's nothing out there that is perfect currently, is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that there's a better trend in medicine than towards more transparency. Less of the, oh, this is an iron standard. You cannot violate this guideline. And then you look and it's all class C or worse evidence, where it's just somebody that got elected to be the president of a society or is an quote-unquote expert. And they're just saying that's what they think we should do. I think it's great that when we don't have great evidence or clear evidence, we just go and say, this is probably just guidance for you. Just try to, you know, this is the general trend we found in medicine or in research, and try to, you know, direct patients along this road, rather than everyone should always do this because someone in the 80s said so.
Absolutely. And then the other piece I like about it, before we talk about some of the studies and some of the other things that we found that weren't necessarily mentioned, is that when it talks about rescreening, so you have a person who's negative, high-risk HPV, when do you rescreen them? When do they come back and do a rescreen for cervical cancer? Again, we're looking for cancer here. This isn't a laughing matter. Very serious. When do you rescreen? And it says no sooner than every 3 years, although the discussion can be had up to 5 years, because that's, as we found, that's what the literature supports. 3 to 5 years, somewhere in there. So if you can just tell your patient, you want to do it in 3 or do you want to do it in 5? Because it appears from the evidence, the best available evidence, that it probably doesn't make a difference in outcomes whether it's 3 or 5 years. But no sooner. That means no more yearly paps, no more yearly pelvic, no more. If you're asymptomatic, no problems, your primary screening, no sooner. And I love the fact that they just come out and say, listen, have a conversation with your patient, but definitely no more yearly, no more yearly for a woman.
And that's, again, guidance. So I love the idea that somebody that knows at least as much as they can know in their field is coming in as a group and getting a consensus and saying, this is what we think everybody else should know, that we don't know enough to warrant more frequent testing than this. We cannot find a benefit from it. But at the same time, you are either a woman getting pap, pelvic, and breast exams that's listening to find out maybe what you could do or what you could discuss with your doctor, or maybe you're a physician or a resident learning about this, at least from our point of view. And I think that's a great way to kind of temper practices, is to say, it looks like these guidelines are an evolution towards doing less often and only sticking with those tests that have the highest yield. You don't want to drag a girl back in routinely for a test that isn't going to help or maybe adds more testing when it comes back abnormal.
Couldn't agree more. I think it is time to dig in a little bit on the literature, some of the studies we found. These are not all the studies that are in the guidance document, so if you check that out, there's even more reading for you to do. But just some interesting pieces, I think, that we found that I kind of want to share here. One of them that I thought was interesting, BMJ 2014, long-term duration of protective effect of HPV negative women, follow-up of primary HPV screening, randomized controlled trial. Just over 12,000 women enrolled, randomized 1-to-1, double-blind, follow-up for 13 years. I'll spare you some of the boring statistics, but essentially whether you had HPV and cytology or just cytology, and when you can retrospectively look at, was the women that had cancer, were they HPV positive or negative, or only cytology positive but HPV negative? And you look at them all, if you had cancer, it was pretty much you had HPV as well. And in fact, in their conclusions, they say double testing is not likely to represent an improvement in effect. While it certainly would increase costs and lower specificity, in a day and age where we're talking about cutting costs in medicine, I don't necessarily see why it's important to add cytology when it's not adding the benefit of finding the cancer.
Yeah, that's huge. And not just not finding the cancer, but you add a low or a poorly accurate test or an inaccurate test that either overdiagnoses or underdiagnoses, either way, but especially in a test when it could be, it has a lot of false positives based on the pathologist, then it's not just the cytology you're paying for, it's the follow-up visit, it's the colposcopy, it's the potential procedures, it's all of that. It's the extra prescription of benzos you're going to give her when you tell her, well, you need to come back in for more testing. I'm not really sure what exactly. It's probably nothing, but... And I think to follow that up, there's a great article published in 2011, and this was in... American Association for Cancer Research did a great study with the Kaiser Group, Portland Kaiser Cohort Study is what it's called, about 20,000 women followed for 18 years, and their punchline when it came to cytology, which is what you were just talking
Whoa,
about.
Whoa, did you say 20,000 women for 18 years?
Yeah, that's a 380,000 patient years worth of data. At a really good healthcare group, the Kaiser Group in Portland, and they did HPV testing of 13 of the strains. They found all kinds of interesting things, but their punchline was that there was a problem because specific comparison was limited between HPV and cytology by the non-specificity, and particularly in older women, those women that are at the highest risk of actually having cancer, equivocal cytologic interpretations that were classified as ASCUS. So those women ended up either going down one road or another, and there were complications from that, and that makes it difficult to compare it to a clear-cut, you have high-risk HPV. That was really easy to compare, but when they had, oh gosh, that just kind of looks, I'm not really sure, on the eyeball test, therefore it's ASCUS. But it could have been maybe a little bit more serious, and so it was hard to really compare those. But they also recommended that HPV had better long-term prognosis abilities, but, you know, that's not what cytology was designed for. Cytology was designed to tell you today what the transitional zone of your cervix looks like.
Exactly. The test, it doesn't necessarily fit the function that we are using it for currently. Don't get me wrong, if they're HPV positive, especially, you know, high-risk HPV positive, these guidelines, depending on what the situation is, either if it's 16 or 18, because that's the ones most likely associated with cervical cancer, you go straight to colposcopy. However, I don't think you'd be in the wrong to necessarily bring them back in 3 to 6 months, retest HPV, and check cytology at that time. But most of the time, the HPV will be resolved. It'll resolve on its own. And in a lot of these studies, that's kind of what we found, is that if it was cancer or if it was something concerning, then it would still be there. However, if not, it would typically resolve on its own. And it's hard to get good data on this, but somewhere between 5 to 45% of women are positive for HPV at some point in their life. However, we know that 5 to 45% of women don't have cervical cancer, which means it will resolve in the majority of women. Another study I think is worth mentioning is Lancet 2014, the efficacy of HPV-based screening for prevention of invasive cervical cancer. Follow-up of four European randomized control trials. This had four randomized control trials, as the title suggests, and get this, 176, over 176 thousand women followed for a median of 6.5 years, which equals 1.2 million patient years.
Did you just say million? Was that an SGEM moment where you say million patient years?
With a pinky ring and everything.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And once again, I'm not going to bore you with all statistics. Because of the combining four trials, you know, obviously some trials followed up for 5 years, some trials about 8 years. There's a little bit different in the follow-up and the patient demographic in each group. However, overall, you have a whole bunch of women randomly controlled to HPV or HPV plus cytology, and HPV was good enough. Cytology didn't add benefit to finding cancer, and I can't stress that enough because too many people say, "Oh, we got to check for." I honestly don't even know what they're checking for, but they, if you're not looking for cancer, medically, other than I don't know what, just looking, I guess. I don't know why you're just down there doing a pelvic exam. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, there's a lot of reasons why we do what we do. Sometimes it's tradition. Sometimes it's that's how you were trained. Sometimes it's because maybe you weren't told the risks and, more importantly, the benefits of what you're actually doing because maybe the attending that trained you, or maybe, I don't know, maybe you've just forgotten to start to keep questioning what you're doing and if there's a benefit to the patient. One last trip back to that July 2011 article in the Cancer Epidemiology and Biomarkers and Prevention article from the Portland Kaiser cohort study. I think it can't be stressed enough. Their last paragraph is a home run hit for me, and it's all the way back in 2011, and it says a double negative result on HPV predicts an extremely low risk of greater than CIN2 in the subsequent decade. They say screening intervals should widen further as successive double negative screenings are accrued. That was their recommendation back in 2011. I'm not saying that's my recommendation, but at some point, these people could be at 15-year windows or longer windows of no longer needing screening.
I think that, I mean, that you're right. That paragraph knocks it out of the park. The you have it now, you have it a negative now, you have another negative, just the HPV. We don't need cytology, just the HPV. You have it again in 2 years. Your likelihood of having cervical cancer in the next 10 years is extremely low. And that says it all. And I think there's a couple things. One is that when we're talking about the SIN2 plus or SIN3 plus is, and I found this kind of interesting digging through the literature, is that there's no uniform, this is SIN2 plus. If I have 100 pathologists and I ask them all, what is this? I'm going to get a bunch of different answers. Not everyone's going to say, oh, that's SIN2 every time. Some are going to say, oh, that's SIN3. Yeah, definitely SIN3. That's, no, that's SIN3. Or sin two. Oh no, that's probably actually just sin one. It varies between pathologists, how many cups of coffee they drank in the morning, what side of the bed they woke up on. You name it, it varies. There's nothing solid about diagnosing it, and I think that is one of the problems when we start getting into cytology and pathology and all that, where we need all we really need is the HPV because HPV is cancer. Positive HPV equals cancer. And that's what needs to be really gathered is that with the cytology and all that, there is a mix where you could have a positive cytology but not have cancer. But it's very unlikely that having a positive HPV or at least high risk HPV for a long period of time that you're not going to develop a cancer.
Yeah, and we just had a great discussion here with at the hospital about the changing guidelines for so that some of the changes that are coming down the pipe are some of the things we've been talking about with a couple of the little more progressive or maybe research-minded attendings. And it basically goes to the same thing that the guidance is, and that's maybe less testing or just HPV. But we've got ASCCP, or the American Society for. Colposcopy and Cervical Pathology. They've got updated management on for consensus guidance on managing abnormal cervical cancer screening tests and cancer precursors, algorithms out for both us and pathologists. We've got new guidance from ACOG, and I think even ACOG acknowledging the fact that probably screening for cervical cancer doesn't need to be done more often than every 3 years. And the USPSTF obviously is going to take the most conservative approach to this, conservative meaning the least amount of testing, unless the testing proves to be a home run. And they also recommend no more than every 3 and potentially a 5-year screening interval for women 30 to 65 that have had negative testing in the past.
It's all heading that way. All less is more. And it's not necessarily less is more in the fact that less is more because anyone, you know, has anything against women or anything like that, but we're not finding cancer. And that is what can't be stressed enough, is that we're not finding cancer when we test more often. In fact, if anything, we're finding false positives. We're finding things that need worked up more. We're finding things that need more biopsies, more follow-up, more time away from work, time away from your family, more anxiety. We're finding more of the bad things, and we're not finding any more of the bad things like cancer. So I like it. And looking through the literature, I honestly can't believe it's taken this long, but I applaud this new guidance, I should say, from Society of Gynecological Oncology and American Society of Colposcopy and Cervical Pathology for coming out and saying, look, we got some new literature in the last couple of years. This needs to be changed, and let's do it.
Absolutely. I mean, you see this everywhere. People are talking about PSAs. People are talking about mammography and a lot of the other screening. And maybe we get a new test so it becomes in vogue to start doing high-res CTs of our patients for lung cancer. You know, and I'm sure in the future, though, that we'll have better data to see if that actually works for us. I know we've already got some data from around the world, but it'll be interesting to see how many screening tests stand up to the test of time.
Couldn't agree more. So you might be thinking, all right, I get it. HPV equals cervical cancer. I got it. High-risk HPV, more importantly, cervical cancer. And you are spot on. So how does that affect the speculum? We'll cover that one in part 3. We'll cover up, like I said, in part 3. This one, we just had to lay the groundwork for part 3, where we will finally put rest to a majority of uses of the speculum. It still will have some function, like a CVP, maybe, or a swan game catheter.
No use for a CVP anymore. But we definitely, there's people that have other problems that aren't STDs, that aren't routine screening. I just think the routine use of different tools or tests in medicine always deserve a second look if they're potentially causing patient discomfort or harm. Or, you know, more likely for some of these women, we have people that are saying, I'm not going to come in because I don't like the speculum. I don't like being on my back with my knees in the air. I just don't like it. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a man and the patients feel that way about me. I've listened to my sister and wife talk about, I don't really like that procedure. And she's always had a female OB doing her PAPs, and she doesn't care for it. She would gladly dodge it. And she has no family history of HPV or of cervical cancer, which I guess the family history of HPV wouldn't matter. But even still, cervical cancer, they don't, and she doesn't have HPV. So that's it's a reasonable thing to discuss.
Yeah, I think because the rates overall of cervical cancer they're low. I mean, we're talking on average 1% to 2% of women, 2% of the highest, 1% is more average, with most of the studies being even less than that. Which is still, it's still 1 out of 100. I mean, that's nothing to mess around with, of SYN3 plus. So that, it's still respectable. But when you're looking at overall cancer deaths, if you look from the CDC literature or data, overall cancer deaths is about 3 out of 100,000. So if we have women that are avoiding the doctor and maybe avoiding their blood pressure, that's the main one I can think of being treated especially if it's really high, that probably has equal, if not worse, depending on their other comorbid conditions and diabetes, you name it, because they're afraid of, or they don't want to have a pap pelvic exam. That's something to note. I mean, that's definitely a harm to the test that doesn't get mentioned.
Yeah, and if your patient's not comfortable coming in because you've told them you're not going to give them birth control before you get their, you know, every 2-year pap smear testing to make sure that they don't have cervical cancer, you know, that I think that's something that the guidelines are going to address very strongly if they haven't already. And I think every organization, every group in medicine is going to be fairly uniformed on less testing, less often, and not restricting access to other opportunities if patients decide they don't want it.
Absolutely. All right. I think this wraps this one up. We are writing for MedPage. Check that one out. It's just search Questioning Medicine and MedPage. As always, write us a review. Write us a review on iTunes. Go in your iTunes app, hit the search button, or your podcast app. Hit the search button at the bottom, type in Questioning Medicine. When all of our episodes come up, on the bottom left-hand corner is the big logo of ours. Click on that, then click on review, and then click on write a review. But remember, only write us a review if you like us, because if you don't like us, we don't want to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely. That includes you, the doctor, almost Dr. Mills, or any of the residents that are listening.
Just give us one review so we can stop putting this plea in at the end. I beg of you. Also, we're going to be in Vancouver in April for the Best Science Medicine Conference, and I know we're both looking forward to that. If you're going to be out there and you want to give a shout-out, want to give us some hate mail in person, we would love to hear from you.
That is going to be awesome. I look forward to this, like, SMAC conference or any of those other big conferences that get me just so excited. It's like Christmas, except better.
That's right. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Andrew Belt, Buelt.
And I'm at MedQuestioning.
And he's at Med, that's right, at MedQuestioning. But you can email us if you don't like Twitter at questioningmedicine@gmail.com. Until next time, put a close to this and keep the quest in questioning.